Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. We often talk about the pursuit of happiness as being an essential human right, but the pursuit of pleasure is one of the central drives that motivate us as humans. And pleasure can take many forms, from meditation or exercise on one hand, to shopping or food, to sex, gambling, or drugs on the other. And whether the pleasures are a virtue or a vice, they all activate an anatomically and biochemically defined part of the brain known as the medial forebrain pleasure circuit. My guest today has examined the neurobiology of that pleasure circuit, trying to unravel it, and how pleasures can become compulsive or addictive. Dr. David Linden is a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's the author of over 90 papers in the award-winning book, The Accidental Mind. He's been a recipient of awards from the Sloan, McKnight, and Klingenstein Foundations, as well as those of the Society for Neuroscience. He's also the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Neurophysiology, and he is the author of The Compass of Pleasure, his latest book, How Our Brains Make Fatty Foods, Orgasm, Exercise, Marijuana, Generosity, Vodka, Learning, and Gambling Feel So Good. This gives you a sense of how this pleasure circuit works in our brain. The book is published by Penguin, and David Linden is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. David Linden, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
This book, The Compass of Pleasure, this is really remaking how we think of addiction and everything, I would think, from obesity to all of our vices, really. Brain researchers have found this spot where this sort of actually control not only our vices, but our virtues.
Yes, that's absolutely true. So we have this region in our brain, and we call it the medial forebrain pleasure circuit. Medial just meaning it's in the middle of the brain, and forebrain meaning it's towards the front, and it uses the neurotransmitter dopamine. And this part of the brain is evolutionarily very ancient. So we share it with lizards and frogs, for example. And this part of the brain evolved so that we would find things like eating food and drinking water and having sex to be pleasurable. And obviously, you want those things to be pleasurable and be rewarded if you want to survive and have children and get your genes into the next generation. And so we have it, lizards and frogs have it, even roundworms, animals that don't have proper brains, have a rudimentary pleasure circuit. So if they're wriggling through the soil and eat a particularly tasty clump of bacteria, their dopamine-using pleasure neurons will fire as well.
So, you know, as we look at brain researchers have been doing all sorts of research, some of it incredibly unethical, we should mention, and you sort of write about that in the book in past years. How was this area of the brain first discovered?
Well, this area of the brain was first discovered with experiments using rats. And so there were some scientists in Canada named Olds and Milner, and they were implanting some electrodes in rat brains, and their electrodes sort of got misguided and landed on a part of the brain that they hadn't intended. And they had their rats running around a large box with four corners, A, B, C, and D, and they found that whenever they would activate the part of the brain where the electrode tip had come to rest while the rat was in corner A, then the rat became very, very interested in corner A and would return there all the time, constantly. And if you then activated this part of the brain in corner B, then the rats really got to like corner B. And what they figured out eventually was that whenever you artificially activated this part of the brain, it was felt as very rewarding or pleasurable to the rat. And subsequently, these experiments were done with monkeys and even in a few cases with humans. And much later, when we had brain scanning machines, fast-forwarding now to starting in the 1980s and 90s, we found that if you have someone and they're very hungry and you have them in the brain scanner and they eat a bite of delicious food, that the medial forebrain pleasure circuit will light up in the brain scanning image. It will become more active. Or if you have them in the brain scanner while they are having an orgasm, it will light up. And it turns out that this part of the brain is naturally activated by these things like eating food and drinking water and having sex, but it can be artificially activated by substances like alcohol or nicotine or heroin or cocaine or amphetamines. All of these addictive drugs artificially activate the brain's pleasure circuit, and that's why we like them.
And actually, we should mention activities can also, you mentioned sex, but gambling or exercise can also access this spot.
That's true. It turns out that it's not just our vices that can activate the pleasure circuit, that also virtuous things can as well. So you mentioned exercise. I think many of your listeners have heard of the phenomenon of runner's high, in which a certain fraction of people feel blissful after very intense exercise. And of course, there's nothing special about runner's high. You can get runner's high from swimming or yoga or cycling or any form of exercise that really gets your heart rate up. In addition, meditation, learning, even donating to charity in many people will activate the brain's pleasure circuit. So it's not just our vices, it's also our virtues as well.
We should mention gambling is not a virtue, but I was saying just for activities, like the act of gambling oftentimes access this spot as well.
It does. So if we have you in a brain scanner, one thing that's maybe not that surprising is if you're gambling, let's say you're playing roulette and you bet on 37 and it comes up and you win. Well, you have some activation of your pleasure circuitry, and that's not surprising.
What about losing? I think at one point you wrote paying your taxes can actually access this spot, which that sounds like the antithesis of pleasure.
Well, it can activate that spot if you have the feeling that paying your taxes is ultimately for the social good.
Ah, I see.
See,
okay.
What has happened is that, if you have a mouse, right, a mouse can have its pleasure center activated by things like eating food or having sex. And, of course, we can, too. But only a human can have their pleasure center activated by something like abstaining from sex or fasting. In the human lineage, there's been a biological miracle that's occurred. And this miracle is that utterly arbitrary things that have nothing to do with getting your genes into the next generation, nothing to do with evolutionary advantage, those things can become rewarding as well. Mere ideas can become rewarding. So if you have a certain set of political or religious or social ideas, then you can get pleasure from fasting or abstaining. A very large amount of our culture, for example, a lot of us enjoy celebrity gossip or the sport of curling. I mean, these are things that don't do us any good evolutionarily, but we find them pleasurable nonetheless. And this is because our ancient pleasure circuits have become heavily interconnected with higher parts of the brain, having to do with memory and emotion and motivation. And this is what allows us and probably also monkeys and whales, other highly developed brain animals, to derive pleasure from things that are arbitrary. So gambling, for example, right? I mean, gambling, your reward is money. Well, money isn't evolutionarily ancient. Money is very recent, and yet we can take great pleasure from getting it. One of the interesting things about gambling is that you don't just get your brain activated when you win. So if we have you in that brain scanner and you're playing roulette, and we monitor the activation of your brain's pleasure circuit while the roulette wheel is spinning, what we find is that as the roulette wheel is spinning, there's a gradually increasing level of activation in your brain's pleasure circuit. And then when the ball falls, if you lose, you take a dip down in activity, and if you win, you take another shot up in activity. But what's really, really interesting is that we are hardwired to find the action, to find the probabilistic uncertainty of gambling rewarding. It's not just the winning.
It's the anticipation.
If you talk to
yeah.
people who are compulsive gamblers, this is what they'll tell you. It's the excitement. It's the action.
Interesting. And I want to go back to the rats for a moment, because this gets into the whole idea of abuse and how we take, these vices, if you will, or virtues, and we can really go overboard on them. Getting back to the original experiment that you talked about with the rats, what researchers found was when they, I think they put a basically a button which allowed them to manipulate this sort of shot of pleasure, if you will, they would neglect everything else. I think you said in a very highly unethical experiment on humans, you had people basically neglecting their grooming, their basic hygiene, and basically just punching the button.
Right. I mean, so if you stick an electrode in the pleasure center and allow people to control activation of that electrode by pressing a button, they will just want to do it all the time. Rats will bang on the lever, and even if you set it up so that they have to bang the lever 100 times in order to get one shock of pleasure, they will do it. And the same with humans. People are extremely motivated to work hard for pleasure. And so if you have these rats, well, these rats, they'll starve themselves to death. They'll ignore food when they're hungry. They'll ignore sex. So if you have a rat and it's sexually receptive and there's a willing rat of the opposite sex who's in heat, they don't care. They'd rather press the button. They will cross shock grids in the cage floor in order to get there. Essentially, it's kind of a horrifyingly accurate model of severe drug addiction. So, you know, basically we're talking about the same thing that happens in late-stage heroin or cocaine or amphetamine addiction, where the drug becomes everything. And this is something that's really crucial. Addictions have the same story. They have the same trajectory. So if we were to take a gambling addict and a heroin addict and a sex addict, and you were asked them to write the story of their addictions, but then before we read them, we hired someone to take out all the words that made specific reference to gambling or heroin or sex, what we would be left with was the same story. And the story would be, well, I did this thing and it felt great, so I did it some more and that was good. And then as I did it more and more, I had to do it more often and more intensely to get the same feeling of pleasure. But then crucially, as time went on, all the liking got transformed into wanting. The pleasure all dissolved away. And in the end stage of addiction, what you have is people who are engaging this behavior, taking this drug or alcohol, not so much because it feels good, but to just avoid the withdrawal symptoms, to be able to get up in the morning and fall asleep at night and not have anxiety attacks or the shakes or the cramps or the chills. And that process in which the like can get transformed into wanting is accompanied by physical changes in the neurons in the pleasure circuitry of the brain.
Mm. And this is causing us to rethink our whole notion of what abuse and what addiction is.
Well, I think the clearest thing that it tells us is that addiction is a disease. Addiction is a disease of the brain. It's in particular a disease of the pleasure circuitry of the brain. Just like when you have heart disease, you have a disease of your heart. But most of us don't treat addicts that way. In other words, if you go into the doctor and the doctor says, well, you know, I'm sorry, you've got heart disease. We don't say, you have heart disease. You suck. You're immoral. You are lacking as a human being. You have heart disease. We say, no, you have heart disease, and it's not your fault. But now that you do, you've got some obligations. You've got to eat right. You've got to take these cholesterol-lowering drugs. You've got to exercise. You've got to see your cardiologist. And if you don't do those things, it's your own darn fault. It's not society's fault. And this should be our attitudes towards addicts. When we have someone who's an addict, we should say, well, look, you have a disease of your brain just like this other guy had with his heart. It's not your fault that you're an addict. But now that you are an addict, it's not a free ride. We shouldn't just say, oh, it's okay, just go steal the radio out of my car. It's fine. We should say, now that you're an addict, you have a set of responsibilities, and they are to avoid the associative triggers for your addiction, the things that you know that will make you crave. You have to actively engage in stress reduction strategies. You should be in therapy or social support, and where safe, effective anti-craving drugs exist to blunt your cravings, you should take them. And if you don't do those things, it's not society's fault, it's your own fault. That's how we should be thinking about addiction. That's what the biology tells us.
And so let's get back to what actually happens, because this was fascinating in the book, too. Before, I want to remind folks, we're talking with David Linden, a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, editor-in-chief of the Journal of Neurophysiology. His latest book is out in softcover, The Compass of Pleasure, How Our Brains Make Fatty Foods, Orgasm, Exercise, Marijuana, Generosity, Vodka, Learning, and Gambling Feel So Good. And it's a really interesting book on how the brain works and what happens when the pleasure circuit in the medial forebrain is activated, is it releases dopamine, some sort of a regular amount of dopamine. Do we know what happens in sort of the abusive personality or the person that will tend to, because some people will eat fatty foods on occasion, other people eat lots of fatty foods, other people will, you know, use drugs occasionally, other people cannot control this. Alcohol the same way, and all of these sort of vices, if you will. What causes some to go towards addiction and what causes others not? Is there something about the way the dopamine is released? Is there differences from human to human?
Well, there are differences from human to human. And so one thing that's important to say is that about 40% in the propensity for of the variation in the propensity for addiction can be accounted for by genetics, by what you inherit from your mother and your father. Now, there's no single gene for addiction. There are many different genes, and we don't know all of them. Not surprisingly, a lot of them have to do with how dopamine functions within the brain's pleasure circuitry. And so it turns out that if you inherit a variant of a dopamine receptor that makes it less efficient, that will make it much more likely that you will become an addict in your life. And you might say, well, less efficient, that doesn't quite make sense. You'd think it would be more efficient that if you get an extra big jolt of pleasure, that that's going to motivate you to then do it more and more and become an addict. But it's a little counterintuitive. So, for example, I'm fortunate enough not to have this variant and not to have an addictive personality. And I go to the bar and I have two whiskeys and I feel slightly tipsy and good and hang out with my friends and go home. Someone else, my friend who inherits this low-functioning dopamine receptor variant, he goes to the bar, and in order to feel as much pleasure as I do, he's got to drink 10 whiskeys and really overdo it. For some reason, we seem to seek a certain set point of pleasure. And if our dopamine systems in our medial forebrain pleasure circuit are less efficient, then we have to overindulge in order to get to that same set point of pleasure that so-called normals can get with much more moderate consumption. So that's the genetic part, but we also know that life experiences is very important. 60% of the variation, and lots of things contribute, but perhaps the most important thing that contributes is stress. Mm-hmm. So we know that life stress makes you more likely to become an addict. If you are in recovery, it makes you more likely to relapse. And you might think, well, stress, you know, now we're talking about a psychological concept. He's gotten away from biology. But we know a lot about the biology of stress. So if you're fighting off an infection, or if you have an argument with your sweetheart, or if you're sacked from your job, any one of those things will cause your adrenal glands that sit on top of your kidneys to secrete stress hormones. And those stress hormones pass into your bloodstream and from there into your brain, and they bind stress hormone receptors on the neurons within your brain's pleasure circuit, and they set in motion a series of biochemical events that will ultimately make you crave. So these are two ways, a genetic way and an experiential way, that determine why it is that some people become addicts and others don't. What we know about stress, the important take-home message here is that if you want to avoid developing addiction, if you come from a family of addicts and you're worried about it, or if you are an addict in recovery and you want to stay clean, one of the very best things that you can do for yourself is to proactively every day engage in stress reduction behaviors. And that can be different things for different people. It can be exercise. It can be playing with your kids. It can be prayer or meditation or listening to music or whatever works. But no one can live a stress-free life. And so active stress reduction strategies are a great preventative.
One of the things you also talk about beyond just the idea of vices and virtues, this pleasure center, It has an effect on other conditions, neurological conditions as well. I think there was a little section where you were talking about Parkinson's.
Well, so it turns out that people, I think most of your listeners know that Parkinson's disease is a disease that is most known by its effect on motor control. So people with Parkinson's develop a tremor, particularly when they're trying to initiate movements of their limbs. And the cause of Parkinson's disease is a gradual degeneration of neurons in the brain that use the neurotransmitter dopamine. But these neurons overlap. Some of these neurons are the same ones that are involved in feeling pleasure. So people in the very latest stages of Parkinson's disease, in addition to having problems with motion, essentially they can't feel pleasure. They become anhedonic. They become very withdrawn. Nothing seems very interesting to them. They don't want to go out. Nothing seems good. Sex doesn't seem good. Food doesn't seem good. New experiences don't seem good. Essentially, the pleasure is removed from their lives, and it's a very sad and debilitating part of Parkinson's disease. Now, what's interesting is people who are partway through the progression of Parkinson's disease receive drugs to boost dopamine function. And what's interesting is if they get a dose of those drugs that's too high, well, they can become very compulsive risk takers. So sometimes people who get too much anti-Parkinsonian drug, they'll go and they'll blow all their money at the casino and engage in risky sex and engage in very risky un-Parkinsonian behaviors if the dose hasn't been adjusted right.
Really? So dopamine is something that needs to be very carefully rationed out then at all times.
Right. It doesn't, and it's a two-edged sword, because you might think to yourself, well, all right, if there's this gene variant in the dopamine receptor that makes you more likely to be an addict, why is it that that hasn't just been selected out by evolution over the years, and why isn't it gone? Well, the answer is twofold. Evolution only cares about you to the point where you, like, have your children and raise them. Evolution doesn't care whether you have a good retirement or whether you live to 80,
right?
Once you've had your kids and raised them up, that's fine. You're done as far as evolution is concerned. The other thing that's really crucial is that these same gene variants that make you more likely to be an addict make you novelty-seeking, risk-taking, and compulsive. Well, when you think about it, novelty-seeking, risk-taking, and compulsive are traits that can actually serve you very well in certain aspects of your life. They can serve you very well in your career, whether you're in business or the arts or education or science or sports or all kinds of areas.
Or neuroscience, for that matter.
When you talk about risk-taking, obsessive, compulsive, novelty-seeking, well, that's Steve Jobs. That's a lot of our entrepreneurial heroes. That's a lot of the people we admire most in this society.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that makes perfect sense. But it's interesting, this looks at it like a dichotomy to me, this idea that Parkinson's sufferers are suffering from a lack of dopamine, and addicts are also inefficient at making dopamine, and yet these behaviors are, it seems contradictory in some way.
Well, so here's the deal. So if you have partially attenuated dopamine function, then you're more likely to become an addict. If you lack dopamine function entirely, then you're absolutely uninterested in pleasure at all. Mm. So that's what resolves that apparent contradiction.
Mm. My guest today is David Linden, a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and the author of The Compass of Pleasure, which looks at how the medial forebrain pleasure circuit affects our behavior. And we've talked about it in terms of vices. Do we see people who become addictive in virtues?
Well, certainly.
Because you said that, this same circuit is touched for, releases dopamine for good acts, and I guess I would think altruistic acts, that sort of feel-good feeling.
Well, right. So we know that the brain's pleasure circuitry can be activated in about, say, two-thirds to three-quarters of people when they give to charity, for example. in one study. Not everyone, but a significant fraction of people. And I don't know if anyone becomes addicted to that feeling. There's no evidence to that per se. But I think all of us know some people where the pro-social act of exercise has become compulsive. You know, addiction is a word that gets thrown around a lot in our culture. Oh, I'm addicted to Starbucks lattes. I'm addicted to sleeping on 600 thread count sheets. Well, those aren't real addictions, right? That's just, you know, we like to use the word as an exaggeration there. But if you have someone who, if they don't exercise, will feel withdrawal symptoms, will not be able to sleep, will get irritated, will not be able to concentrate, where it will interfere with their life, well, you know, that person is certainly become compulsive and might even be accurately described as an exercise addict if that starts to interfere with their life. So basically, if it activates the dopamine system repeatedly and strongly, that behavior, whether it is pro-social or antisocial, can become a basis for addiction, whether it is sex or gambling or drugs or even exercise.
Well, let me ask you very quickly. I assume with this much knowledge, are we close to some sort of therapy that would manipulate this part of the brain to sort of create a regular release of dopamine, or is that still beyond us at this point?
Well, it's very, very early days. In other words, people have been searching for a long time for drugs that will help recovering addicts blunt their cravings. And right now, there are just a couple of drugs. There's a drug called naltrexone that seems to help people who are recovering alcoholics stay clean, and which may also hold some promise for heroin, amphetamine, and cocaine addicts. There's a drug called varenicline that seems to help people with cravings for nicotine, although there is some concern about it with cardiovascular side effects. But it's very, very early days. I predict 20 years from now we will have many more safe, effective anti-craving medicines in our armamentarium that will help recovering addicts stay clean in these situations. Right now, we've only got a few, and we don't understand them very well.
More research. As you wrote at the very beginning of the book, this is the time to be in brain research. We're finding new things about how our brain operates every day, aren't we?
This is the golden age right now. My students here at Johns Hopkins, I always tell them, you know, people are going to look back at this time and say, this was the golden age of brain research, and you're in it right now. And I don't just say them to get them all pumped up and excited. It's genuinely true. Right now is when the mysteries of the brain are being unraveled, and it's an extraordinarily exciting time to be a brain researcher.
The name of the book is The Compass of Pleasure. David Linden, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on, Rich. I appreciate it.
Dr. David Linden is a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the author of The Compass of Pleasure, How Our Brains Make Fatty Foods, Orgasm, Exercise, Marijuana, Generosity, Vodka, Learning, and Gambling Feel So Good. The book is published by Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.